Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. First of all, an article published by the Religion News Service on the 4th of January, entitled "Haredi Jewish Organization Lashes Back at New York Times Over Reporting on Schools," by Yonat Shimran. Agudath Israel of America, a lobbying group on behalf of Haredi Jewish synagogues and schools, has mounted an aggressive media and billboard campaign answering a New York Times investigation into New York State's private yeshiva schools. The campaign, with a new website and at least three billboards in Manhattan, accuses the newspaper's investigation of threatening Haredi Jews' safety and way of life at a time when anti-Semitism against Jews is rising. One prominent poster juxtaposes two panels. "Two-time New York City anti-Semitic attacks doubled," reads one. The other reads, 12 New York Times articles against Orthodox Jews in 3 months. "We believe their reporting is unfair and in many cases biased," said Rabbi Yitz Frank, Ohio director of Agudath Israel. "It creates a negative tone about our community among the public. That's what we're worried about." The new website, called KnowUs.org, points to the growing incidence of violence against Orthodox Jews in New York enclaves, concluding, "A major newspaper launching a campaign against a minority group is always wrong. In this climate, it is deeply concerning." The New York Times investigation into the schools, which began with a front-page story in September, found that New York area yeshivas deprive students of secular education. So much so that at one school, all 1,000 students failed the standardized test in reading and math. The stories reported that some students have been subjected to physical abuse from poorly paid, unqualified teachers. Meantime, the paper reported, these yeshivas have taken in more than $1 billion in federal, state, and local taxes over the past 4 years alone. Shortly after the first story was published, the paper reported that the largest such yeshiva school in New York State, the Central United Talmudical Academy in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, agreed to pay fines and restitution totaling more than $8 million for paying teachers off the books and requesting reimbursements for meals for students that it never actually provided. A spokesperson for the Times said the paper was confident in the accuracy of its reporting. "Our reporters have spent months seeking to help readers understand what is happening inside some of New York's lowest performing schools, speaking to hundreds of parents, students, and educators to explain the inner workings of Hasidic Jewish religious schools, which receive substantial amounts of public money," the spokesman said in an email. Rabbi David Swiebel, executive vice president at Agudath Israel, would not disclose how much money it was spending on the campaign. Agudath Israel is New York State's third largest educational lobbyist, behind New York State Association of Independent Schools and the New York State Catholic Conference, a nonprofit group set up to challenge the yeshiva to improve secular education, said the campaign was misguided. "They're a multi-million dollar lobbying firm that invests heavily in getting funding for these schools," said Beatrice Weber, executive director of Young Advocates for Fair Education, or YAFT. "They feel incredibly threatened by these issues." Weber, whose organization is cited on the KnowUs website as a source of the Times' criticism of Haredi schools, said it was dangerous for Agudath Israel to conflate rising anti-Semitism with the New York Times investigation. "There's real anti-Semitic things happening, but it's not investigative reporting from the New York Times," Weber said. "That's not where anti-Semitism is happening." Now an article from the Associated Press, published on the 10th of January, entitled Saudi Arabia, Hajj Pilgrimage Returning to Pre-COVID Levels, by John Gambrell. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Islam's annual Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia will return to pre-pandemic levels this year after restrictions saw the annual religious commemoration curtailed over concerns about the coronavirus, authorities say. The Hajj, required of all able-bodied Muslims once in their lifetime, represents one of the world's largest gatherings of people. Before the pandemic, the pilgrimage drew millions each year to Islam's holy city of Mecca, home to the cube-shaped Kaaba that observant Muslims pray toward five times a day. In 2019, over 2.4 million people took part in the pilgrimage. But in 2020, amid the lockdown sparked by the pandemic, Saudi Arabia drastically curtailed the Hajj, with as few as 1,000 residents of Saudi Arabia permitted to take part. It was an unprecedented move, unseen even during the 1918 flu epidemic that killed millions worldwide. In 2021, some 60,000 residents of Saudi Arabia attended. Last year saw 3 million faithful perform the pilgrimage. Speaking on Monday night at a conference about the Hajj in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah, Saudi Hajj and Umrah Minister Tawfiq bin Fazan al-Rabia announced the lifting of the restrictions. I bring you two bits of good news in this meeting. The first, the return of the number of pilgrims to what they were before the pandemic without any age restrictions, al-Rabia said, according to the state-run Saudi press agency. And the second, allowing any Hajj mission from around the world to deal with any licensed company that meets the requirements of the pilgrims of those countries, he added. Only those between the ages of 18 to 65 could attend the Hajj in recent years. Saudi Arabia also has lifted which private companies could conduct travel arrangements for the Hajj. The coronavirus isn't the first public health disaster to strike the Hajj. The kingdom's Al-Saud ruling family stakes its legitimacy in this oil-rich nation on overseeing and protecting the Hajj sites. Ensuring the Hajj happens has been a priority for them and also a main economic driver, bringing billions of dollars of non-oil revenue to Saudi Arabia. Disease outbreaks have always been a common concern surrounding the Hajj. Pilgrims fought off a malaria outbreak in 632. Cholera in 1821 killed an estimated 20,000, and another cholera outbreak in 1865 killed 15,000 before spreading worldwide. More recently, Saudi Arabia faced danger from a different coronavirus, one that causes the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. The kingdom increased its public health measures during the Hajj in 2012 and 2013, urging the sick and the elderly not to take part. In recent years, Saudi officials also instituted bans on pilgrims coming from countries affected by the Ebola virus. It wasn't immediately clear what health precautions would be taken for the Hajj, which falls according to the lunar-based Islamic calendar this year at the end of June. While Saudi Arabia has no requirement for coronavirus vaccines or testing, it does require pilgrims to be vaccinated for other maladies. Muslims have been prohibited from kissing or touching the cube-shaped Kaaba, the metaphorical house of God at the center of Mecca, that pilgrims circle as they complete the Hajj. The Hajj also involves close contact in large crowds, which in 2015 saw over 2,400 people killed in a crush and stampede. Now an article from the Religion News Service that was published on the 13th of January, entitled, A Historic Meeting of Orthodox Christian Scholars Convenes to Confront Divisions and War. by Megan Salishvila. Nearly 400 Orthodox Christian theologians from 44 countries convened in the largest international conference of its kind in Greece on January the 12th to discuss Nicaea-sized questions facing the Eastern Orthodox Church amid war and bitter division. Some of the most contentious issues at the mega conference of the International Orthodox Theological Association meeting in Volos have been exposed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine last February, which exacerbated a split between a newly independent Orthodox Church of Ukraine in Kyiv and the Russian Orthodox Church based in Moscow. The conference's keynote speaker, Metropolitan Ambrosios Zagrafos of Korea, an exarch of Japan, a bishop of the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, told the assembly that the various branches of Orthodox Christianity had fomented a heresy by taking sides in the war, calling it an unspeakable travesty that, as a result, most Orthodox leaders have failed to condemn this diabolical war unequivocally. We cannot even say, well, this is a war driven by politicians. Our churches are against it, Ambrosios said, because so few of our church leaders have actually taken a public anti-war stance. At the root of the Russia-Ukraine split is a theological heresy called ethnophilitism that conflates church and nation, Ambrosios said. The practice of applying church governance based on ethnicity, nationality, or culture, rather than geography, the Metropolitan said, is nothing less than the greatest danger to the Orthodox unity of the church. The effects of ethnophilitism often lead to church members excluding Christians who don't match their particular ethnic identity, however subtly, or to elevating nationality over faith. The debate over the ideology has led to finger-pointing. Critics of the Moscow Patriarchate point out that the Russian church has expanded into jurisdictions such as Africa, where they had no canonical authority. Critics of the Patriarchate of Constantinople point out, on the other hand, that in 1922, the Greek Patriarch established Greek Orthodox churches in the U.S., rivaling the Russian church's presence. Russian-led organization of the Orthodox churches in the U.S. shifted after the Russian Revolution and amid waves of immigrants from Eastern Europe who requested priests from abroad to serve them. Some argue completely eliminating ethnophilitism would mean consolidating the independent Orthodox churches in the United States, such as the Greek, Serbian, Antiochian, Russian, and others that currently overlap their jurisdictions into one Orthodox church for the region. Ambrosios' diagnosis broadly echoes a contingent of Orthodox scholars and clergy who oppose Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That includes the event sponsors, the International Orthodox Theological Association, the Orthodox Theological Studies Association, and the Volos Academy for Theological Studies. The scholars represent some 28 areas of study, including women in the church, asceticism, science and technology, political theology, and more, all under a theme of mission and the Orthodox Church. Members of the Moscow Patriarchate attended too. The mega conference of the International Orthodox Theological Association has become a most, if not the most, significant gathering of Orthodox Christian scholars from throughout the world, said the Reverend Anton Vrain, a member of the IOTA board and a professor of religious education at Holy Cross Greek Orthodox School of Theology in Brookline, Massachusetts. The spirit of the conference is joyous, with a strong sense of unity among the diverse members. IOTA held its first conference in Romania in 2019, fostering collaboration among Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant scholars. The conference aims to help church leaders continue Orthodox traditions in modern context, said IOTA President Paul L. Gavriluk. He listed religious fundamentalism, climate change, the pandemic, economic uncertainties, and the war in Ukraine as pressures on the church to respond to world affairs for the sake of serving Christ and the church. Pandelis Kandiakas, director of Volos Academy, told the audience that the mission of the church cannot be only a theoretical or historical concern, but must also be a contemporary one, since God's revelation takes place in history. Many see the Russian church's support for the war in Ukraine as an unfortunate outcome of ethnophilatism, expressed as a Russian world ideology. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Patriarch Kirill of the Moscow Patriarchate have often invoked this ideology, which says that a transnational Russian sphere of influence called Holy Russia has a common political center, spiritual center, language, church, and patriarch that co-labor with the national leader to govern and uphold morality and culture. But the effects of Orthodox fragmentation can be seen not only in Ukraine, but also every Orthodox jurisdiction, some conference participants say, from Western Europe in the U.S. to Africa and East Asia. Gavriluk led a prayer for the victims of war in Syria, Afghanistan, and Ethiopia, where fragile peace has recently ended a civil war along ethnic lines, with Oriental Orthodox Christians on each side. He said the Orthodox Church must be more than an ethnic club. Of particular concern to critics of the members is the establishment of Russian churches in regions where other branches of Orthodox Christianity already have a foothold, such as Ambrosio's jurisdiction in Korea, where a canonical order states that only one bishop should serve all languages and ethnicities. The Moscow Patriarchate has also been rapidly expanding across Africa, stepping on the Patriarchate of Alexandria, which, since the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, has operated on a decree of territorial sovereignty over North Africa. The Russian Church declared Alexandria to be in schism after its patriarch recognized the independence of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, granted by the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I in 2019. The promising revival of Orthodoxy in the 20th century is also being endangered by the serious problems that arose after the fall of communist regimes and so-called Orthodox countries which have sought to expand into other ecclesiastical jurisdictions, Ambrosio said. In 2016, the Council of Crete condemned not just ethnic particularism, but also a kind of nationalism that further restricts belonging and mutual acceptance. But such pronouncements have had little effect in the past. The Eastern Orthodox Church condemned ethnophilatism as heresy at the 1872 Council of Constantinople, but only Greek-speaking church leaders were present, and the move was ignored in practice. Still, Gavriluk is hopeful that the conference can lead to real reforms in the Orthodox Church. With the attendance in Volos of Russian Orthodox members and the sheer size of the meeting, he said, with the characteristic reserve of a churchman, such a hope is not unsubstantiated. Now an opinion piece published by the Religion News Service on January the 16th, entitled, In Honor of Dr. King, Demand Our Elected Officials Expand Voting Access, by Nick Bates. As a deacon in the Evangelical Lutheran Church and the director of Hunger Network Ohio, I believe we all have a moral obligation to make sure more people's voices are heard in our democracy, not fewer. Not only in Ohio are we seeing elected officials make it harder for people to vote, but also across the country, state legislatures and governors are dedicated to creating barriers by limiting ballot boxes, requiring photo ID at the polls, and introducing other immoral measures. As we honor the legacy and activism of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we must hold tightly to our responsibility of loving, listening to, protecting, and serving our neighbors. One of the most important ways people in this nation are able to use their voice is by voting. Unfortunately, so many election laws, like the one Ohio Governor Mike DeWine just signed, draconian policies Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida has pushed through, and new bills being introduced in Texas, will make it harder for people to vote. And we will be seeing other state legislatures in 2023 try to pass similar pieces of legislation. This is the exact opposite of what we owe each other. And that's exactly why we cannot stay silent in the face of disenfranchisement. As we honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s life, work, and legacy, I think of the call to love our neighbor. Something most faith traditions have as a core tenet. One of the most clear ways God calls us to show love is by listening to what others say, especially those who are typically not heard in our communities. Big money interest and politicians can buy TV ads during a football game or fly banners across the field in front of tens of thousands of people. But for many of us, the best way for our voice to be heard is by using our sacred right to vote. I work throughout Ohio with faith leaders who are committed to protecting our elections and who are on the ground at the polls. I've also been an election worker myself. In all of my combined decades of experience, we have not witnessed voter fraud. Report after report shows our election system in Ohio is safe and secure. Even Governor DeWine and our Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, have said in statements that we have a secure election system already and that it is relatively problem-free. Similarly, in other states, politicians claim their state and our country need more election security, but fail to cite any evidence of significant election fraud. It should make us all wonder why the changes. In my view, election integrity means that all registered voters have access to the ballot and all ballots are securely and fairly counted. Through food pantries and other ministries, I have met many people who are working hard and barely scraping by. Expanding absentee voting access helps these families. The expansion of early voting opportunities and absentee ballot access after Ohio's difficult 2004 election allowed those individuals the opportunity to make their voices heard. Sadly, these voting restrictions are taking Ohio in the wrong direction. As a loving state, we should expand access, not limit it. In 1776, the founders of our nation had a radical idea that people should have the opportunity to elect their representatives. Since then, we have expanded that radical notion to women, African Americans, and indigenous people, even to 18 to 21-year-olds. Dr. King was called a radical for having the audacious thought that the words of our founding fathers should be taken seriously. What may have seemed radical to King George in the 1700s is not a radical notion today. We must pray, organize, and lift our voices to guarantee all votes are counted, all votes are treated equally, and all voters have access to the ballot box. One of the things I love about being in the church is that we can always dream about the world we want for ourselves and our communities. Our ultimate goal is to give everyone dignity and opportunity in our communities. We can best achieve that by making sure every voice is heard at the ballot box. Today, let us honor Dr. King and continue the tradition of putting the power in the hands of the people by demanding our elected officials in Ohio and across the country expand voting access. Together, as a multi-faith and multiracial coalition, we can create a world where everyone has the ability to thrive and live in the dignity God wants for us all. Though Dr. King may no longer be with us, his work lives on, and we must continue to pursue the dream. And our last piece is an excerpt of an article published by the Religion News Service on the 16th of January, entitled, 35 Black Churches to Receive Total of $4 Million for Preservation Work, by Adele M. Banks. Nearly three dozen historic black religious sites will receive a $4 million infusion of funding to help them with renovations and preservation of their buildings across the country. The National Trust for Historic Preservation's African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund announced on January the 16th that 35 churches are the recipients of the first round of its Preserving Black Churches grants. The Lilly Endowment is funding the $20 million initiative. We focus not only on the preservation of the physical buildings, but also on the profound stories embodied in their walls, landscapes, cemeteries, and beyond, Brent Leggs, executive director of the fund and senior vice president of the trust, told RNS. Their role as centers of black religion, culture, and service is fundamental to understanding the lived experience of black Americans. The fund, which describes itself as the largest dedicated to preserving African American historic locations, has raised more than $80 million since its launch in 2017. The grant announcement was timed to the holiday honoring the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. The grants, from $50,000 to $200,000, based on the scope and scale of the projects, will aid churches from Alaska to Alabama that are often some of the oldest buildings in their communities and could benefit from the money to help with long-term maintenance, immediate repairs, or future public presentations. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.